Chapter 63. In which Joe Sedley takes care of his sister, thus all the superior officers being summoned on duty elsewhere, Joe Sedley was left in command of the little colony at Brussels, with Amelia invalided, Isidore, his Belgian servant, and the Bon, who was made of all work for the establishment, as a garrison under him. Though he was disturbed in spirit, and his rest destroyed by Dobbin's interruption, and the occurrences of the morning, Joe's nevertheless remained for many hours in bed, wakeful and rolling about there until his usual hour of rising had arrived. The sun was high in the heavens, and our gallant friends of the TH miles on their march, before the civilian appeared in his flowered dressing gown at breakfast. About George's absence, his brother-in-law was very easy in mind. Perhaps Joe's was rather pleased in his heart that Osborne was gone, for during George's presence, the other had played but a very secondary part in the household, and Osborne did not scruple to show his contempt for the stout civilian. But Emmy had always been good and attentive to him. It was she who ministered to his comforts, who superintended the dishes that he liked, who walked the road with him as he had many, too many, opportunities of doing, for where was George? And who interposed her sweet face between his anger and her husband's scorn. Many timid remonstrances had she uttered to George in behalf of her brother, but the former in his trenchant way cut these entreaties short. "I am an honest man," he said, "and if I have a feeling I show it, as an honest man will. How the deuce, my dear, would you have me behave respectfully to such a fool as your brother?" So Joe's was pleased with George's absence. His plain hat, and gloves on a sideboard, and the idea that the owner was away, caused Joe's I don't know what secret thrill of pleasure. "He won't be troubling me this morning," Joe's thought, "with his dandified airs and his impudence." "Put the captain's hat into the anteroom," he said to Isidore, the servant. "Perhaps he won't want it again," replied the lackey, looking knowingly at his master. He hated George too, whose insolence towards him was quite of the English sort. "And ask if madam is coming to breakfast," Mr. Sedley said with great majesty, ashamed to enter with a servant upon the subject of his dislike for George. The truth is, he had abused his brother to the valet a score of times before. Alas! Madam could not come to breakfast, and cut the tartans that Mr. Joe's liked. Madam was a great deal too ill, and had been in a frightful state ever since her husband's departure, so her bonne said. Joe's showed his sympathy by pouring her out a large cup of tea. It was his way of exhibiting kindness. And he improved on this. He not only sent her breakfast, but he betted him what delicacies she would most like for dinner. Isidore, the valet, had looked on very sulkily, while Osborne's servant was disposing of his master's baggage previous to the captain's departure. For in the first place he hated Mr. Osborne, whose conduct to him, and to all inferiors, was generally overbearing, nor does the continental domestic like to be treated with insolence as our own better-tempered servants do, and secondly, he was angry that so many valuables should be removed from under his hands, to fall into other people's possession, when the English discomfiture should arrive. Of this defeat he and a vast number of other persons in Brussels and Belgium did not make the slightest doubt. The almost universal belief was that the Emperor would divide the Prussian and English armies, annihilate one after the other, and march into Brussels before 3 days were over. When all the movables of his present masters, who would be killed, or fugitives, or prisoners, would lawfully become the property of Monsieur Isidore. As he helped Joe's through his toilsome and complicated daily toilette, this faithful servant would calculate what he should do with the very articles with which he was decorating his master's person. He would make a present of the silver essence bottles and toilet knick-knacks to a young lady of whom he was fond, and keep the English cutlery and the large ruby pin for himself. It would look very smart upon one of the fine frilled shirts, which, with the gold laced cap and the frogged frock coat, that might easily be cut down to suit his shape, and the captain's gold-headed cane, and the great double ring with the rubies, which he would have made into a pair of beautiful earrings, he calculated would make a perfect Adonis of himself, and render Mademoiselle Rienne an easy prey. "Oh, those sleeve buttons will suit me," thought he, as he fixed a pair on the fat pudgy wrists of Mr. Sedley. Long four sleeve buttons, and the captain's boots with brass spurs, in the next room, corbleu. What an effect they will make in the olivert. So while Monsieur Isidore with bodily fingers, was holding onto his master's nose, and shaving the lower part of Joe's face, his imagination was rambling along the green avenue, dressed out in a frogged coat and lace, and in company with Mademoiselle Rienne. He was loitering in spirit on the banks, and examining the barges sailing slowly under the cool shadows of the trees by the canal, or refreshing himself with a mug of faro at the bench of a beer house on the road to Lincoln. But Mr. Joseph Sedley, luckily for his own peace, no more knew what was passing in his domestic's mind than the respected reader, and I suspect what John or Mary, whose wages we pay, think of ourselves. What our servants think of us. Did we know what our intimates and dear relations thought of us, we should live in a world that we should be glad to quit, and in a frame of mind and a constant terror that would be perfectly unbearable. So Joe's man was marking his victim down, as you see one of Mr. Painter's assistants in Le Dental Street ornament an unconscious turtle with a placard on which is written, "Soup tomorrow." Amelia's attendant was much less selfishly disposed. Few dependents could come near that kind and gentle creature without paying their usual tribute of loyalty and affection to her sweet and affectionate nature. And it is a fact that Pauline, the cook, consoled her mistress more than anybody whom she saw on this wretched morning. For when she found how Amelia remained for hours, silent, motionless, and haggard, by the windows in which she had placed herself to watch the last bayonets of the column as it marched away, the honest girl took the lady's hand, and said, "Tenez, madame, est ce qu'il n'est pas assez alarmé, mon ami moi." With which she burst into tears, and Amelia falling into her arms, did likewise, and so each pitied, and soothed the other. Several times during the forenoon Mr. Joe's Isidore went from his lodgings into the town, and to the gates of the hotels and lodging houses round about the park, where the English were congregated, and there mingled with other valets, couriers, and lackeys, gathered such news as was abroad, and brought back bulletins for his master's information. Almost all these gentlemen were in heart partisans of the Emperor, and had their opinions about the speedy end of the campaign. The Emperor's proclamation from Avesnes had been distributed everywhere plentifully in Brussels. Old ears. It said, "This is the anniversary of Marengo and Friedland, by which the destinies of Europe were twice decided. Then, as after Austerlitz, as after Wagram, we were too generous. We believed in the oaths and promises of princes whom we suffered to remain upon their thrones. Let us march once more to meet them. We and they, are we not still the same men? Soldiers. These same Prussians who are so arrogant today were 3-1 against you at Jena, and 6-1 at Montmirail. Those among you who were prisoners in England can tell their comrades what frightful torments they suffered on board the English hulks. Madmen! A moment of prosperity has blinded them, and if they enter into France it will be to find a grave there. But the partisans of the French prophesied a more speedy extermination of the Emperor's enemies than this, and it was agreed on all hands that Prussians and British would never return except as prisoners in the rear of the conquering army." These opinions in the course of the day were brought to operate upon Mr. Sedley. He was told that the Duke of Wellington had gone to try and rally his army, the advance of which had been utterly crushed the night before. "Crushed, sah," said Joes, whose heart was pretty stout at breakfast time. "The Duke has gone to beat the Emperor as he has beaten all his generals before. His papers are burned, his effects are removed, and his quarters are being got ready for the Duke of Dalmatia, Joe's informant replied. Added from his own Mater Dottel, Mylor Duke de Richmond's people are packing up everything. His grace has fled already, and the Duchess is only waiting to see the plate packed to join the King of France at Ostend. The King of France is at Ghent, fellow, replied Joes, affecting incredulity. He fled last night to Bruges, and embarks today from Ostend. The Duc de Berry is taken prisoner. Those who wish to be safe had better go soon, for the dikes will be open tomorrow, and who can fly when the whole country is underwater? Nonsense, sir, we are 3-1, sir, against any force Boney can bring into the field, Mr. Sedley objected. The Austrians and the Russians are on their march. He shall be crushed, Joe said, slapping his hand on the table. The Prussians were 3-1 at Jena, and he took their army and kingdom in a week. They were 6-1 at Montmirail, and he scattered them like sheep. The Austrian army is coming, but with the Empress and the King of Rome at its head. And the Russians, bah! The Russians will withdraw. No quarter is to be given to the English, on account of their cruelty to our braves on board the infamous pontoons. Look here, here it is in black and white. Here's the proclamation of His Majesty the Emperor and King, said the now declared partisan of Napoleon, and taking the document from his pocket, Isidore sternly thrust it into his master's face, and already looked upon the frogged coat and valuables as his own spoil. Joe's was, if not seriously alarmed as yet, at least considerably disturbed in mind. I've me my coat and cap, sir, said he, and follow me. I will go myself, and learn the truth of these reports. Isidore was furious as Joe's put on the braided frock. Isler had better not wear that military coat, said he. The Frenchmen have sworn not to give quarter to a single British soldier. Silence, sirrah, said Joe's, with a resolute countenance still, and thrust his arm into the sleeve with indomitable resolution, in the performance of which heroic act he was found by Mrs. Rawdon Crawley, who at this juncture came up to visit Amelia, and entered without ringing at the antecomer door. Rebecca was dressed very neatly and smartly, as usual. Her quiet sleep after Rawdon's departure had refreshed her, and her pink smiling cheeks were quite pleasant to look at, in a town, and on a day, when everybody else's countenance wore the appearance of the deepest anxiety and gloom. She laughed at the attitude in which Joe's was discovered, and the struggles and convulsions with which the stout gentleman thrust himself into the braided coat. Are you preparing to join the army, Mr. Joseph? She said. Is there to be nobody left in Brussels, to protect us poor women? Joe succeeded in plunging into the coat, and came forward blushing and stuttering out excuses to his fair visitor. Ah, was she after the events of the morning, after the fatigues of the ball the night before? Monsieur Isidore disappeared into his master's adjacent bedroom, bearing off the flowered dressing gown. How good of you to ask, said she, pressing one of his hands in both her own. How cool and collected you look, when everybody else is frightened. How is our dear little Emmy? It must have been an awful, awful parting. Tremendous, Joe said. You men can bear anything, replied the lady. Parting or danger are nothing to you. Oh, now that you were going to join the army, and leave us to our fate. I know you were, something tells me you were. I was so frightened, when the thought came into my head, for I do sometimes think of you when I am alone, Mr. Joseph, that I ran off immediately, to beg and entreat you, not to fly from us. This speech might be interpreted, my dear sir, should an accident befall the army, and a retreat be necessary, you have a very comfortable carriage, in which I propose to take a seat. I don't know whether Joe's understood the words in this sense, but he was profoundly mortified by the lady's inattention to him during their stay at Brussels. He had never been presented to any of Rawdon Crawley's great acquaintances. He had scarcely been invited to Rebecca's parties, for he was too timid to play much, and his presence bored George and Rodden equally, who neither of them, perhaps, liked to have a witness of the amusements in which the pair chose to indulge. H. thought Joes, now she wants me, she comes to me. When there is nobody else in the way, she can think about old Joseph Sedley. But besides these doubts, he felt flattered at the idea Rebecca expressed of his courage. He blushed a good deal, and put on an air of importance. I should like to see the action, he said. Very man of any spirit would, you know. I've seen a little service in India, but nothing on this grand scale. You men would sacrifice anything for a pleasure, Rebecca answered. Captain Crawley left me this morning as gay as if he were going to a hunting party. What does he care? What do any of you care for the agonies and tortures of a poor forsaken woman? I wonder whether he could really have been going to the troops, this great lazy Germund?
Oh, dear Mr. Sedley, I have come to you for comfort, for consolation. I have been on my knees all the morning. I tremble at the frightful danger into which our husbands, our friends, our brave troops and allies, are rushing. And I come here for shelter, and find another of my friends, the last remaining to me, bent upon plunging into the dreadful scene. My dear madam, Joes replied, now beginning to be quite soothed, don't be alarmed. I only said I should like to go what Britain would not. But my duty keeps me here. I can't leave that poor creature in the next room. And he pointed with his finger to the door of the chamber in which Amelia was. Good noble brother, Rebecca said, putting her handkerchief to her eyes, and smelling the eau de cologne with which it was scented. Have done you injustice. You have got a heart. I thought you had not. Oh, upon my honor, Joe said, making a motion, as if he would lay his hand upon the spot in question. You do me injustice, indeed you do, my dear Mrs. Crawley. I do, now your heart is true to your sister. But I remember 2 years ago, when it was false to me. Rebecca said, fixing her eyes upon him for an instant, and then turning away into the window. Joe blushed violently. That organ which he was accused by Rebecca of not possessing began to thump tumultuously. He recalled the days when he had fled from her, and the passion which had once inflamed him, the days when he had driven her in his curricle, when he had knit the green purse for him, when he had sat enraptured gazing at her white arms and bright eyes. I know you think me ungrateful, Rebecca continued, coming out of the window, and once more looking at him, and addressing him in a low tremulous voice. Our coldness, your averted looks, your manner when we have met of late, when I came in just now, all proved it to me. But were there no reasons why I should avoid you? Let your own heart answer that question. Do you think my husband was too much inclined to welcome you? The only unkind words I have ever had from him, I will do Captain Crawley that justice, have been about you, and most cruel, cruel words they were. Good gracious! What have I done? Asked Joes in a flurry of pleasure and perplexity. What have I done to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.